It's June 21st, 2025, in Astoria, Queens. Next Tuesday, we have a primary election. I'm standing on a stranger's porch, looking at plastic bins filled with campaign literature. Soon, I'll bring them to my car and take them to a staging location nearby, where hundreds of volunteers will show up to grab materials and fan out across the neighborhood, knocking thousands of doors. My name is Tim Donovan. I've lived in Astoria, Queens for 15 years now, and counting. I spent a decade as a bartender in the neighborhood too, at a bougie cocktail and oyster bar called Mars on 34th Ave and 35th Street. I'd never done anything like this before in my life. But before I can tell you the story of that primary election, we've got to go back 7 years to a long-shot candidate running for Congress, a 29-year-old former bartender who used to go by Sandy.
The numbers that you're seeing right now.
I cannot believe these numbers right now, but I do know that every single person here has worked their butt off to change the future of the Bronx and Queens. That's what I know.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory over Joe Crowley in 2018 would inspire a revolution that transformed New York City's politics over the next 7 years.
Zoran reached out to me. He told me he was going to run for office and he needed a website.
The first bread pickup we did in this truck, we filled this truck top to bottom and we did it out of my friend Cody's kitchen, in which you literally could not move.
With a margin that narrow, you know, when it's 55 votes, it's like...
So I turned to my mother and I was like, I have to go right now. I said, Amazon just pulled out of the deal and I have to go. I have to leave right this second, mommy.
It's funny. The first time someone called me comrade in 2019, it was like a little strange. And I was like, okay, sir.
It culminated in, I was in Astoria Park watching the sunrise over the Hellgate.
This is the story of how a neighborhood in Queens became a laboratory for a new kind of politics, and how it took me 7 years to get off the sideline and join in. Welcome to the People's Republic of Astoria. This is episode 1, 10 Perfect Strangers. Shauna Moorlach started canvassing in 2018. She'd go on to knock tens of thousands of doors.
I'd never volunteered ever before, and I jumped in feet first. I think I did something like 3 shifts a week for like 6 months. I saw that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was running for Congress in my district.
So then let's go back even further. So you've never done it before. You decide you want to get involved. What did that look like?
Yeah, you know, I'm a geriatric millennial, so I'm, you know, right on the cusp of Gen X. And so I was very much into Facebook at the time.
Back then, Shauna was the mother of a 4-year-old daughter. And with Trump in office, she was pissed.
When Trump won in 2016, it just really was like eating a hole in my psyche. It was just nonstop stress, you know, the constant doom scrolling, just everything seeming like it was on fire around me.
In 2016, I got involved too. I joined the Democratic Socialists of America, the Queens County Young Democrats, and for a few months, I went to all the meetings. I showed up, I listened, I tried to figure out where I fit in. I wanted to learn how all these systems operated, but it all just felt like social gatherings, networking events, mixers. I felt like I should be handing out business cards and holding a lukewarm cup of coffee. What was more talking supposed to accomplish? I didn't last 6 months. Shauna was just getting started.
Actually, so the very first like local political activity that I did was the Women's March protest in 2017, which was like cathartic and it felt good to yell, you know. But after that happened, I was like, okay, well, now what?
Now what? It's a question I was asking myself too, at least for a while. In 2016, I was 31 years old, working at Mars part-time, trying to make it as a freelancer, writing about politics for venues like Salon.com, Vice News. Honestly, I'd write for anyone who'd pay me. One time, I made $100 writing a piece about my cat. I'm mostly doing stories about income inequality, the student loan debt crisis, climate change, you know, fun stuff. But I really loved it for a while. I thought I'd found a way out. Out of the rut I'd been stuck in, out of the restaurant industry I was coming to hate, out of whatever vague feeling of powerlessness I couldn't quite articulate that had pervaded my life. I wanted to be a voice for all the people like myself who didn't have the opportunity that I'd stumbled upon. And I thought that's how I could make a difference, by being that voice, telling their stories, or speaking for them. But looking back, that's not how you make a difference. Not really. It would take me 10 more years to figure that out, to meet the people who would show me a better way.
And so when I saw that AOC was running, and this was like pretty early, I'd say January of 2018, something like that, I saw that it was happening. I went to a local canvas in Astoria Park.
Shauna was new to organizing, but even the people running it back then were inexperienced.
It's funny, at that time, it was really like a scrappy, you know, project. I was just like one of maybe 10 people at this canvas, which is a lot. But for a congressional campaign, you need to like really hit as many doors as you can. So I went out on my own from the very beginning. Yeah, I was just feet first.
The campaign staffers that day were cynical about their chances.
I do remember one of them saying, we're not going to win this campaign. Like that Joe Crowley is just like too powerful, you know. We're just really like trying to build out infrastructure and like, it's wonderful that you're here and thank you. But, you know, maybe trying to set expectations low.
Because back then, Astoria was different.
Western Queens had always been politically moderate to conservative.
Donald Trump comes from Queens. Andrew Cuomo comes from Queens. Archie Bunker comes from Queens.
Archie Bunker territory.
I didn't have no million people out there marching and protesting to get me my job.
No, his uncle got it for
it. Astoria still got some of that old New York feel. Butchers and fishmongers still exist here, though fewer and fewer as time goes on. There's a street called Steinway that's filled with Egyptian grocers and hookah lounges. The sweet smell of shisha overwhelms your senses as you walk down it. And Astoria is an old ethnic enclave, too. Mostly Greeks and Italians. A place stuck in the past. Or at least, it used to be.
Hard left, 28-year-old named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
She comes up and picked me to do the, do a trial run and like, I'll be the person on the doors and you be the canvasser. And I was so awkward and weird and nervous. But yeah, I remember thinking back to what that guy was telling me, that like, oh, we can't win. And I was like, I don't know. I think she might actually be able to, you know, there was that thing with her. And I was like, I think we can do it.
So Shauna started knocking on doors repeatedly.
I probably had the same TERFs. Like, so a TERF is an assignment for you, like for, you know, a number of doors to go knock on. And I probably did that same TERF 5 times. I don't know. I did a lot of the same doors over and over and over. People were like, I'm so sick of seeing your face. Like, go away.
While Shauna was learning how to canvas, a young activist named Michael Thomas Carter was trying to make a decision of his own. Should he hold it, fold it, go all in?
I'm always looking for that line, that play that maybe you win with it, maybe you lose with it. It's almost like when you're playing poker, right? And like both the world where you win and the world where you lose exist simultaneously in that moment.
Michael was a young man in his 20s living in Brooklyn, and the Bernie campaign had just lost. He was asking himself the question, now what?
I worked the last 5 days of the primary. My first day was the Washington Square Park rally with 20,000 people, which was wild.
But through the Bernie campaign, he'd joined a nascent movement. And that would lead him to new opportunities.
And so when I heard that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was running, I got an email in my inbox saying, I'm running for Congress against Joe Crowley.
Michael replied to the email. He would become the second paid employee of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's primary campaign.
And I said, hey, if there's anybody who we as a movement, as a Democratic Socialist movement, as a left movement, as a Bernie progressive movement could take out and make a huge impact, it would be Joe Crowley.
In 2008, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was just a 19-year-old sophomore at Boston University, her father died suddenly of a rare form of lung cancer. For the next 4 years, her family would find themselves lost in the Byzantine processes of the Westchester County surrogate court system. In interviews she gave 10 years later during her congressional campaign, she described a system of court-appointed lawyers who were, quote, shaving off fees. To stay afloat, her mom worked two jobs while she bartended. In a Newsweek piece from the time, her mother Blanca describes real estate people coming around, snooping outside their house, taking photos. You can almost picture their mouths watering. AOC declined to be interviewed for this podcast, but she's spoken publicly about these experiences.
My first interview with Alexandria was after an Abolish ICE protest in Foley Square. We kind of like went to the protest and then we had a talk, like kind of in the square, in the street, about the race, how to move forward, plans to win, all of that. And then I was brought on board. My first day of work was in Alexandria's apartment in Parkchester. She had a sign on her wall that said Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for Congress. And it was like me, VG, and her boyfriend, Riley, and her.
As Michael was getting involved in AOC's campaign, I was just working at Mars, not involved. And when I heard that a young bartender was running against a local congressman, I asked myself, how the hell would she take down Joe Crowley?
Joe Crowley, at the time, was the head of the Queens Democratic Party machine, somebody who was widely touted as being the next Speaker of the House for the Democratic Party. So a very powerful person in a lot of different ways.
This story was part of the Democratic machine. It was very Greek. It was very pro-police.
Ross Birkin is a journalist, novelist, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and former state Senate candidate. You'll hear more from him in episode 2. He's been writing about New York and Queens for years.
The old machine bosses had machines. They had clubhouses and people they would turn out.
There are three lawyers in the Queens Democratic Party of that era, and they're still around, actually, Sweeney, Reich, and Bowles, who created a system whereby they would automatically represent people who were in foreclosure or inheritance disputes and thereby make millions of dollars from the loss of homes by working class people in Queens.
In Westchester, that same system had been bleeding fees out of the small nest egg left to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's family when her father passed away suddenly in 2008. For Alexandria, this whole story was personal. And in Queens, where she was running, Joe Crowley's allies had it down to a science.
And the reason they were able to control that is because of the control they have over the judge selection process. Really, there's been a lot of writing about this, a lot of coverage, a lot of journalism that you can look up.
Crowley, through his position in Congress, through the fact that he was a very good inside operator, the fact that he had a lot of influence in the city council, he was very close to Christine Quinn, who was the powerful council speaker. His predecessor, Tom Manton, had helped pick council speakers as well.
By 2018, Crowley had stopped organizing his district. But in his defense, who wouldn't have? It had been 14 years since he'd even had a primary challenge. He'd won 10 elections in a row by more than double digits. His predecessor had handed him his seat.
I mean, you had real patronage operations. The Queens Democratic Party had a patronage operation through the court system, somewhat, and through City Hall as well, and through the City Council. But it was not nearly as extensive as kind of the old line patronage operations were. The machine was not really a machine anymore. There was very little political organizing the Democratic Party in Queens did by the 2010s, but he wielded a lot of soft power. He didn't live in the district. He lived in Virginia. He lived in a very nice house in Virginia, which was known. I mean, AOC very wisely made an issue in the race, and in her great ad, still to this day, maybe the best political ad ever created, she made that point very plain about how Joe Crowley did not breathe the air and drink the water we do. And that was very compelling.
Foreclosure, doesn't live here, doesn't send his kids to our schools, doesn't drink our water or breathe our air, cannot possibly represent us.
I mean, that election, I mean, it was about progressive, you know, it was about a progressive candidate versus a centrist and the defeat of the center by the left. But really, it was also about someone who was organizing the district against someone who wasn't.
Let them know that this is just the beginning.
In 1852, a young man named William Meeker Boss Tweed was appointed to the New York County Board of Supervisors, a new bureaucracy. It was a small, unimportant body, except that it had the power to slow down city projects. And Tweed, he was always looking for an angle. Soon, they were slowing down anything that didn't give them a little fee. And so, from that humble perch, Tweed would begin a decades-long career of graft and backroom politics that would ultimately transform and reshape the city in ways that are still reverberating to this day. In New York, they'd call it Tammany Hall. Other places just call it corruption. For over a century, Tammany Hall had taught New York City's political operators the same lesson. Boss Tweed once put it plainly. "I don't care who does the electing," he said, "as long as I do the nominating." By the mid-1980s, a former police officer from Queens had learned that lesson well. It's 1986, and Tom Manton is a new member of Congress, a backbencher with little power. But when Queens County Democratic Party Chairman Donald Maines is caught in a corruption scandal involving the city's parking meters, Manton senses an opportunity. Soon, he's positioned himself as the new chairman of the county Democratic Party and starts making moves straight out of old Boss Tweed's playbook. When surrogate judge Luis Loino is set to retire, Manton times Loino's resignation to 1 week after the deadline to deliver petitions for candidates. Manton handpicks Luino's successor, and just like that, his law firm, Manton, Sweeney, Gallo, Reich, and Bowles, is being assigned cases in the surrogate court. But Tom Manton doesn't stop there. Soon, Gerard Sweeney, a partner at his firm, is named counsel to the Queens Public Administrator, a position that Sweeney still holds to this day. To maintain control of the local political machine, Manton's old law firm, now known simply as Sweeney, Reich, and Bowles, keeps a close connection with the Queens Democratic Party. They offer free pro bono legal services to all party-endorsed candidates. They're well known for being experts at election law, often challenging petitions to keep primary challengers off ballots. By 1998, Manton was growing old and recognized that he couldn't maintain control forever. So he decided to pull the same trick one last time, declaring he wouldn't seek re-election just after the deadline for new candidates had already passed, allowing him, in his role as the leader of the Queens County Democratic Party, to hand-pick his successor. Just like old Boss Tweed, Manton didn't particularly care who was voting in elections as long as he could control who was being nominated. And the person that Manton handpicked? A 35-year-old state assemblyman named Joe Crowley.
So you look at the machine circa 2018, it had all the vestiges of power. And it had all the deference, and that was the key. Joe Crowley had a lot of deference in the New York political world.
By the time primary day rolled around, AOC's army of volunteers had knocked over 100,000 doors in her district, spanning the Bronx and Northwest Queens. Crowley's campaign stuck to the old method, tried and true. Blanket the airwaves with TV ads. Hit radio. Get glossy mailers in every mailbox. He'd raised over $3 million, most of it from corporate PACs and financial firms. AOC only raised $800,000, mostly from small donors, people like me. The machine still had the money. It still had the endorsements. What it didn't have?
When there's a real ideology, you get a level of commitment that money can't buy.
And so, yeah, just hit doors in my area. It works. We really crush it in Queens.
As spring arrived in 2018, the volunteer lists were growing. Election night, June 2018.
She's right here. I can't let you
know. Oh my God. She realized she won on live television on New York One.
How are you feeling? Can you put it into words?
Nope. I do know that every single person here has worked their butt off to change the future of the Bronx and Queens. That's what I know.
You know, that was the Queens that I beheld. It was Joe Crowley's Queens.
He was basically the muscle or the figurehead behind this organization. They called him the King of Queens.
That's Michael Lang, a local journalist who specializes in New York City politics.
But then, you know, the first time he has to run a real race in a long time against someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, he is kind of revealed to be more of a paper tiger, especially exposing the machine's lack of actual political power with the electorate in places like Western Queens, where you have younger, newer-ish residents who just have no reason to obey the quote-unquote political machine, who have no ties to any of these institutions that kind of prop it up.
And I think that would have fallen apart eventually, I do. But without AOC, it would not have moved on an accelerated timeline. I mean, the collapse of it came very rapidly. Once Joe Crowley was beaten, a lot of people understood he was not the only one, that you could run primaries. Tiffany Caban almost beating Linda Katz in the borough of Queens was massive. Seeing her, the turnout for her in Western Queens, the new era had arrived.
So how do 10 people in a park beat a 10-term incumbent congressman with $3 million in the bank, who has all the union endorsements, all the political endorsements, who controls the whole local political machine? The answer turns out to be simpler than anyone could have expected. You just show up. Oh, also, it really helps if your opponent doesn't.
Veteran New York City Democratic Congressman Joe Crowley has gone down to primary defeat tonight after he sent a stand-in to represent him at a recent debate. The New York Times editorial board wrote, "If you want to be speaker, don't take voters for granted."
The establishment had gotten lazy.
When young voters are kind of given a stake in politics and really reached out to, as they have been in like a couple places, they do show up. You're betting on like college educated young people who grew up in the era of Obama, Bernie Sanders, and Trump, who are already extremely politicized because that is the world we're living in. That's actually kind of a good bet.
Many of those folks, maybe their dad was a lawyer and they're not, and they're trying to be an actor or an artist, or they're a barista, or they're whatever, and they're struggling for the first time in their life with money. With rent, with the million daily indignities that you go through when you're a working class person. That changes your perspective. It changes the way you see things. And it's a big part of this youth realignment, particularly middle class or upper class youth, that in previous eras would have been expected to have politics that more closely mirror their parents' politics and more closely mirror their class position in society.
I'm not the best educated, well-read socialist, not doing the book clubs. I'm more of just like a person who arrived to this place because I deeply care about my neighbors and wanting to take care of like everyone, no matter who they are, where they live. It's like we can do this over and over and over. It's not just one shot or two shots. And it's like building up a culture of service.
6 years later, in 2024, Donald Trump was reelected president, and a whole new generation of activists were sitting at bars, doom-scrolling on their phones. But this time, there were organizations to plug into. Magdalena Miranda was just a 24-year-old activist at the time. When Shauna was working to get AOC elected in 2018, she was still just a child.
I remember watching AOC's campaign launch video and crying. Like, I was in high school. I showed all my friends. It was super exciting. I was still in the Mid-Hudson Valley at the time then, so no connection to the People's Republic yet. But yeah, that was, like, instrumental.
By her freshman year of college, she was already phone banking for a housing justice organization in the Hudson Valley, where she lived.
And so, yeah, that was my, like, first dip into community organizing, and I was like, wait, I kind of love this. This is great. All this stuff that I've only ever thought in my head and, like, actually doing something about it, actually seeing, oh, we passed this thing. And now the city has rent control. Or now the city has good cause eviction. So I feel like getting that sense of it's not just things online. It's not just voting. You can actually go out and, like, I have some sort of agency over these things and, like, being able to create change.
Soon, she was joining the Democratic Socialists of America. By the time she moved to New York in early 2024, she was fully plugged in with the organization.
And I just loved canvassing in the city so much because you get to talk to so many people and there's no driving involved. Like, literally your turf could be just one block and you're, like, talking to all these people. I was like, this is incredible. DSA had, like, a rose card system where it's like a punch card. I ended up filling, like, 2.5. I think I have them hanging on a wall somewhere. So, like, the punch cards had 10 for, like, 10 canvases, and I filled up 2.5 and I was like, oh, this is great.
Much like Shauna, Magdalena would be at Zolan's first campaign canvas. She got to work immediately.
I set out being like, I want to canvas once a week. And especially towards, like, that final month, it ended up being more like 3-4 days a week.
November 6th, 2024.
Presidential election night. Watch party was at Catch. Zoran actually came in to the watch party that night. We knew what was happening. We knew Trump was getting elected. It was actually, like, very nice to see Zoran and, like, get to say hi.
For Magdalena, that question, now what? It already had its answer.
This is what we need to focus on. We are going to elect this man. This man is going to become our next mayor.
The politics, the policies, the doom scrolling, the rage, that might have been the impetus for this work at first. But for Shauna and Magdalena and thousands like them, that's not what kept them coming back.
Oh, I'm, like, creating real change, but also, like, I love doing this with these people.
I'm still, to this day, friends with a lot of people that I met through that race, like, and even people that aren't even necessarily, like, doing electoral organizing any longer.
Largely, a lot of the people I hang out with and, like, a lot of my social circle is people who do this kind of work.
You know, we're very intentionally trying to make DSA a home for people, not just for politics, you know, but just as a communal space for people who, you know, deeply care about society and, like, taking care of your neighbors and trying to, I guess, rebuild those places that we've lost.
The post-canvas social is so crucial to building a canvas. That's where the bonds form. That's where people, like, want to come back and canvas with you again the next week.
You know, usually people substitute this with their work. You make your work friends and then you go to another job and, like, you probably don't keep in touch with those people anymore. But I'm seeing the same people year after year after year after year with our electoral campaigns.
I don't remember if I was working at Mars the night that AOC won, but it wouldn't have made a difference. Places like that exist as a refuge from politics. It's a place to sip cocktails and forget about real life. Shauna Morlock had knocked on doors 3 nights a week for 6 months, with a 4-year-old child at home. Michael Thomas Carter went all in on a 10% chance. 10 people in a park had transformed into hundreds, and then thousands. And a 29-year-old bartender had just taken on a 10-term congressman and won. in a few short months, they'd done something real. Something that actually worked. And me? I joined a few organizations, quit them the moment it seemed pointless. I tried to make a difference, but decided it was a waste of time. So I deleted Twitter, stopped reading the news. It was comforting not to watch the world fall apart. And I told myself they didn't really need me. Not here, in the People's Republic. I could take comfort in the fact that I was happy. I really was. I really am. My wife has a great job. I've got amazing family, great friends. I get to spend my days in the greatest city in the world. But what I didn't have was an answer to a simple question that Shauna and Michael and Magdalena had all figured out. Now what? That's because for 7 years, I'd stopped asking completely.
Every volunteer thing, you're fighting the couch. It's either you or someone staying home on their couch. So it's like, you need to make it enticing enough that someone wants to come talk to strangers and knock on doors at 7 p.m. on like a Tuesday.
Really, the political leadership in New York sowed the seeds of their own demise. They imported a bunch of people that they thought would sort of act politically in the way that their parents might have acted, but they put them in a context that led them to act politically in a much more radical way than they anticipated.
There's lots of people who are going up and down here, and I think the world can be better, and that we have a position and like we have a job to do to try to make it better. You can't just wait for other people to do it for you. And it feels good. And so we're trying to build it ourselves.
Next time on the People's Republic of Astoria, episode 2, 20 years apart.
She gave me two names. One seemed like he couldn't do it or didn't want to do it. And the other person was this 26-year-old organizer they'd hired, and his name was Zoran Mamdani.
I mean, billionaires don't lose. Trillion-dollar corporations don't lose. Real estate developers in New York City don't lose. And when they lost, they were f***ing pissed.
The People's Republic of Astoria is written, narrated, and produced by Tim Donovan. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. For show notes, more information, and episode transcripts, visit the website at peoplesrepublicpod.com. Music by Perosian. Special thanks to my wife, Alice, for all of her great ideas, her constant advice, and her endless support. Without her, none of this is possible. Thanks to Daisy LaRome and Sarah Noe. Thanks to Shauna Morlock, Michael Thomas Carter, Magdalena Miranda, Ross Birkin, and all the other guests. See you next time in the People's Republic.
You gotta be ready.